I'd like to introduce you to Dr. Gillian McIntyre. I'm particularly pleased to be introducing someone whose capacity and talent and potential is being developed and flourishing, I hope, within the Glasgow School of Social Work. Gillian started her PhD research in the old Department of Social Policy and Social Work at the University of Glasgow. But by the time that she had completed it, she, like us, had made the transition to the Glasgow School of Social Work over here. She completed her PhD in 2006. And it's that study that she's going to talk to you about today. And I think we can take it from the fantastic attendance and the generally excellent response that this is an area which is highly topical and significantly under-researched, so we are confident that Gillian has got a particularly important contribution to make to developments in Scotland and further afield. So I'll hand you over to Gillian now.
Thanks, Fergus. Okay, thanks very much to everyone for coming along today. It's nice to see so much interest in this area, which, as Fergus has said, hasn't been, up until this point anyway, there hasn't been a great deal of research done in this field. So really what I'm here to do today is, just having completed my PhD relatively recently, I really just want to share with you some of the findings that came out of that piece of research. The aim of the research was to look at the transition from childhood to adulthood for young people with learning disabilities in Scotland, with a particular focus on further education, training and employment opportunities for young people. The young people who took part in the research, just to set the context for you a wee bit, these were young people who were classified as having a moderate learning disability. They were classified in that way by psychological services, and they came from two local authority areas in Scotland, Glasgow and Renfrewshire. These young people were assessed by psychologists, and their information was kept on a database. Although within the category of moderate learning disabilities, there was a very wide range of abilities and different needs, and so that was interesting in itself. The research, what I really wanted to do with the research was actually to look in depth at the experiences of the young people from their own perspective. Not much research in the field of learning disabilities has actually spoken to young people themselves to ask what they feel and what they think. And so really my role in the process was to act as a voice for these young people. I took their experiences on board and I'm presenting them to you now. So the research took place at a time of changing structures of support for young people leaving school. At the time, there's particularly in relation to attitudes and expectations for people with learning disabilities, those have changed quite significantly in the last 10 years or so, particularly since the National Review of Learning Disabilities, The Same As You. There's much greater expectation that people with learning disabilities now should be able to do what they want with appropriate support, living within their own communities. And so the research took place at this time. There's a whole new industry basically has sprung up around further education, training and employment within Britain. We're seeing, for example, in the field of further education, since the introduction of the 1992 Further Education Act, it's actually profitable for colleges of further education to have students with learning disabilities on their courses. They receive enhanced payments for having those students on the courses, so obviously that makes it financially attractive for them. Alongside those changes, we have the introduction of Careers Scotland, which is a new all-age guidance service. And they have a role particularly working with vulnerable and at-risk people. In England, there was a parallel development with the introduction of the Connections Service, a careers guidance service for young people who are seen as being at risk. We also have a wide range of new training programmes in place for young people, both generally in the population, but also for people with learning disabilities or other support needs. And the particular one of significance here is the Get Ready for Work programme, and I'll touch upon that again a bit later. We've also got a huge increase in supported employment in Scotland and in the rest of Britain, and that's really been regarded as the way forward for people with learning disabilities. Just to set the policy context then, and I'm guessing that most people will be familiar with some of these policy documents, so I don't want to say an awful lot about these at the moment. I just want to touch on them briefly. The first document of particular significance was the report of the Beattie Committee, which reported in 1999, and that report was entitled Implementing Inclusiveness, Realising Potential. And that committee was established in Scotland to look at young people who are not in further education, training and employment. This group is now known as the NEETS group, and the Scottish Executive are putting quite a fair amount of resources into working with this group of young people. That group of young people doesn't only include people with learning disabilities, but people with a wide range of additional support needs. So young people who are leaving care services, young people from refugee and asylum communities, just a very broad group of young people who have additional support needs and difficulties in terms of accessing employment and training. Scotland currently has one of the highest rates of young people not in employment, education or training in Europe. And so the Scottish Executive are really trying to tackle that at the moment. So what the Beattie Committee did was came up with a set of recommendations in order to tackle this problem. They introduced some inclusiveness projects across Scotland, 7 projects in total, with a range of staff whose role was to provide much more intensive support than had previously been provided for young people. The principle of inclusiveness runs right the way through the recommendations that were made by the Beattie Committee. So what we have now are these Beattie Key Workers who work intensively with young people to look at ways to improve their employability. Again, there are issues around improving young people's employability because the onus is then on the young person to change rather than looking at how we can change structures and systems within society. But again, that's an issue we might discuss later on. In addition to this, the Beattie Committee recommend the introduction of a new training programme, the Get Ready for Work programme, which replaced the Skill Seekers programme for young people with special needs. They also introduced a post-school psychological service to further enhance the psychological input that young people received, which currently finishes when young people leave school. And they also recommended the introduction of supported employment projects to support young people to move into employment. So the next relevant piece of policy legislation, if you like, was the Same As You, which was a national review of learning disabilities services in Scotland, and that was published by the Scottish Executive in 2000. Most people will be familiar with the Same As You, which looked at all aspects of life for people with learning disabilities and the services that were currently in place and what we should aim for in the future. Particularly in relation to employment, the Same As You suggested that people with a learning disability should have a job with appropriate support if that's what they want, and that there shouldn't really be any reason why that can't happen. They suggested local authorities should give increasing attention to developing employment services, and they also suggested that Job Centre Plus and Careers Scotland should give more attention to people with learning disabilities. So they were advocating increased support, but within mainstream settings where possible. Finally then, the Additional Support for Learning Act, which was introduced in 2004 in Scotland. And the key thing that this did, which is relevant for this presentation today, was change the category of young people who were eligible for support. So what we've seen a change from is a move from special educational needs to additional support needs. And then the significance of that is the category of additional support needs is a much, much broader category that can include a greater number of young people. the positives of that was that it was a recognition of the support needs of people whose needs previously hadn't been met. But there are huge resource implications to that, and there are some concerns that young people with learning disabilities will be competing with a much larger group for scarce resources, and that might lead to some problems later down the line. It's too early to look at say what the implications of that will be at the moment, but it's just something to bear in mind as we go through the talk. As I said, the focus of the research was looking at employment and further education and training for young people, but it was within the broad context of transitions, so looking at the transition from childhood to adulthood. And what we know already from the existing literature is that the transition from childhood to adulthood is becoming much more problematic. There's a whole wealth of research within the youth studies tradition which shows us that transitions are increasingly unstable, they're taking longer, they're much less linear than previously and much less predictable than previously. There's changing patterns of transition for young people within the general population relating to the school to work transition. People take much longer and the routes that they're taking are much more complicated than previously. Leaving home, that's another transition that's taken much longer for many people in the population. Probably a lot of you will know, you've probably got sons and daughters yourself who are always leaving home and coming back, and that's the sort of thing that's happening now. Having children and getting married, the majority of young people are taking longer to do that. Although it's important to note there's increasing polarisation between those young people who have opportunities and those who are disadvantaged. A lot of disadvantaged young people are actually making these transitions sooner than before, so leaving home earlier, having children earlier, and so there is an increasing polarisation there. In terms of young people with disabilities, there hasn't been an awful lot of research looking at the transition from childhood to adulthood, but what we do know is that young people with disabilities, as well as facing these increasing problems that young people in the general population are facing, are also having additional barriers to overcome as a result of their disability, and we'll look at those in more detail during the rest of the talk. What I want to do now is tell you a bit more about what the research involved. It took a case study approach, and by that I mean I worked with a group of 20 young people with, as I said earlier, who had been classified as having moderate learning disabilities. I worked with those young people in an in-depth way over a period of 9 months. In terms of recruiting the young people, I did that with assistance from Careers Scotland, who gave me access to a database. The information was anonymised, and young people were selected at random. They were then contacted by Careers Scotland and asked if they would be willing to take part in the research. And only when young people agreed to meet me was I given their contact details. I then went along to young people and spoke to them in a bit more detail about what the research involved and allowed them to make the decision about whether to take part or not. So as I said, 20 young people with moderate learning disabilities were tracked for a period of 6 to 9 months. When I say tracked, that's not a very nice expression. I interviewed them once at the start of the 9 month period to talk about what they'd been doing since they left school, what they hoped to do in the future, what their experiences had been, what barriers they'd faced, and that kind of thing. It was very unstructured, and it really allowed the young people to talk about issues that were important to them. They were then, over a period of 9 months, kept in touch with the young people, and they kept me up to date on anything of significance or importance that was happening in their lives. And at the end of the period, I went back and interviewed them again, and we discussed their progress in terms of their aspirations and their goals and what they hoped would happen next. So that allowed me to paint quite a detailed picture of what was going on in the young people's lives. But in addition to this, I also completed a range of significant other interviews with people who were nominated by the young people. So that included parents, careers advisors, employers, college lecturers, social workers, really whoever the young person felt was significant in their lives. And by asking young people to nominate people, it gave them slightly more control over the research process. For each young person, around four or five significant other interviews were carried out. And what that really allowed me to do was to build an even more detailed picture and also clarify any issues that weren't completely clear from talking to the young person. The final thing was a range of key informant interviews, which really were to put the whole thing in context in terms of policy. And so I spoke to representatives from the Scottish Executive, from local authorities, education and social work departments, from the voluntary sector, from further education, and also from the field of supported employment. And putting all that together got quite a detailed picture about what was going on in terms of further education, training and employment for young people with learning disabilities. Also, I just want to say a wee bit about service user and carer involvement in the research. That's something that is highly topical at the moment and is something that I believe really strongly in. I believe it's very important to involve service users and carers as much as possible in the research process. To that end, I was able to work quite closely with a young man who had a learning disability himself. Originally, I wanted to have an advisory group of people with learning disabilities, but the logistics of that were too difficult. So I worked with one young man who was involved in the process from the beginning in terms of helping to design interview schedules, piloting the interview schedules, and in terms of analysis of data, we worked together to discuss what the key issues were that were coming out of the data. Probably now, having gained more experience of the research process, I can see ways that I could have done that in a more meaningful way. But at that time, it seemed like the best option. And I do feel quite strongly committed that it did improve the research overall and made it relevant to the lives of people with learning disabilities. So what actually happened to young people with learning disabilities after leaving school then? Of the 20 young people, 16 went on to further education college after leaving school, and that fits with the picture that we already have from previous research, which shows that further education is by far the most common route for young people with learning disabilities. 2 years later, five of the young people were still at college, two were on a training course, five were in employment, and seven were economically inactive. I should just say at this point that the research took place 2 years after the young people had left school, so it gave us a better idea of the journey that they had taken rather than working with people who were in the process of leaving school. And since leaving school, more than half of the sample had four or more placements, and some had as many as eight, and that illustrates the really unstable nature of transition for this group of young people. One of the key things that came out of the research was the difficulties that young people had in actually sustaining placements. Young people seemed to find it not so difficult to find a training place or to find a job, but actually sustaining that place was really, really difficult. And that's one of the issues that we'll come on to talk about. Young people in the study were less likely to be in paid employment than young people in the general population. They were more likely to be in further education or training, but they were much less likely to gain qualifications as a result of that further education. And despite the barriers faced by young people, the majority of them still aspired to find employment in spite of those barriers. So, given that the majority of the young people went on to further education, we spent quite a lot of time talking about their experiences in this field. Interestingly, the majority of young people moved to segregated provision within mainstream further education colleges, and that was the case even if they had went to a mainstream secondary school. They still moved from mainstream provision into segregated provision within further education. They tended to do what were known as development or extension courses, and those courses were really about giving people tasters of the world of work, focusing on things like independent living, travelling, life skills, and that kind of thing. So they were very much vocational in nature. There was a move away from the academic side to looking at things in a more vocational way. People tended to have tasters of bricklaying courses, hairdressing and that kind of thing. And within these courses, young people weren't likely to attain any qualifications at the end of those courses. Young people valued the courses, and their families did too, because it allowed people to develop soft targets. When we say soft targets, we're talking about things like increasing self-confidence, improved self-esteem, that kind of thing. Just developing general experiences. And young people also valued the courses for the social opportunities that they provided. The courses were less successful, though, in terms of meeting hard targets, such as attaining qualifications, and very few of the young people who took part in the research had the chance to work towards a qualification. But young people valued being given the chance to be more independent and treated like an adult. This was something at school they felt very overprotected, and the move to college was seen as a new start and something where they could become much more adult-like. And they talked about things like being able to call lecturers by their first name, that kind of thing. They just valued being treated as an adult. And young people really enjoyed undertaking subjects that were more vocational in nature, such as hairdressing or bricklaying. And one of the things that was really interesting about that was a lot of the young people perceived the learning disability to end after they left school. Moving on to college and doing different things made them feel that they no longer had a disability. And that's something that's really interesting, and it raises issues around whether the education system actually creates learning disabilities or learning difficulties. So, overall then, college was valued, but there were some negative features. It didn't really prepare people for what would happen next. There was a trend for young people to complete one course, move on to another course. It's called the revolving door cycle. People just do one course, then another course, then another. Some writers have suggested that colleges provide a warehousing function. And basically the role of college is to give people with learning disabilities somewhere to go after leaving school. Depending on your own viewpoint will depend how you see the function of colleges. Some people see it as a really useful stepping stone, but some people suggest that segregated provision within further education is just day centre provision in a different setting. But you'll have your own views on that, and that might be something that we can discuss later. So if we look then in more detail at young people's experiences of training and employment. Employment can be seen as a route out of poverty and social exclusion. But as well as that, it provides young people with daily activity, and it can help to increase self-confidence and control over day-to-day life. For the young people in the study, financial reasons were really not the most important consideration, and very few people talked about valuing employment because of the money that they would earn. People tended to value things like getting out of the house, getting away from their mum, that kind of thing, and they really valued meeting new people and having new experiences in a new environment. The type of work undertaken by young people in the study tended to be routine manual work that was poorly paid. For example, there were kitchen people working as a kitchen porter within offices as an office assistant, where they performed tasks like stuffing envelopes, working in retail, working as care assistants, and working in catering. But something that was quite significant was that the majority of young people, either within an employment situation or within a training situation but within the workplace, tended to be behind the scenes, and that was something that was really important. So in terms of one young girl, for example, who really wanted to work in fashion, so she got a job in a shop, a clothes shop, but rather than being out engaging with people and working in the store, she was unpacking boxes in the storeroom. So people tended to be kept behind the scenes. In terms of what made a successful employment placement then, there were a few key things that were identified. was really important to match young people's aspirations with the placement, and there wasn't much evidence of that actually going on. One young man, for example, was very keen on the travel industry, and his ambition had always been to work in the airport. And he realised that might be difficult to get a job in the airport, but he said he would even have been happy working in a shop in the airport. So the training agency got him a job in McDonald's. And so it seemed that his aspirations and his goals hadn't been taken into account at all. Having a supportive employer was also crucial, and it seemed to be the key thing for having a successful placement was having a supportive employer. The key feature of a supportive employer was someone who was willing to be flexible and to change employment practices within the workplace. And that wasn't necessarily a big thing. Very, very small, minor changes could make a huge difference and could prevent a placement from breaking down. It's also really important to have supportive colleagues. One of the key principles of supported employment is that originally a young person will have a placement with a support worker from an outside agency who will then gradually take a back seat as natural supports develop within the workplace. So having supportive colleagues who can provide those natural support mechanisms are really, really important. Again, that didn't happen in many cases. Which was disappointing, but where there were successful placements, supportive colleagues were a key part of that. So we have to ask what the potential for employment and training is in terms of social inclusion. It seems that for young people, they valued the social aspects of employment. People talked a lot about having a laugh with their friends in work, meeting new people, and that kind of thing. But in reality, people's lived experiences tended to be sitting in the canteen on their own at lunchtime or going home and having lunch in the family home. And they tended to be excluded from quite a lot of social events within the workplace. They very rarely socialised with colleagues outside the workplace. And a lot of that wasn't necessarily about attitudes. There were a lot of structural barriers there too. So, for example, many of the young people worked for a small number of hours each day, and so they might have come into the workplace between 10 and 2. So they left before everyone else did in the evening. So when everyone else at the end of the day was going off down the pub, the young people had already gone home. So there were structural factors. It wasn't only about attitudes there too. In addition, in terms of potential for social inclusion, it seems that it was beyond the scope of the study to look at finance, but given the nature of the work that the young people were doing, it seems unlikely that they would be better off financially as a result of their employment. In fact, most people would have been better off staying on benefits. From the research then, it was possible to identify a number of barriers that were faced by the young people. The first one related to expectations, and that could operate as a barrier on a number of levels. For young people, unrealistic expectations occurred in terms of their understanding of the nature of employment and the nature of the workplace. Young people were often sent from a training course into a place of employment with a very unrealistic idea of what that job would involve, and that resulted in young people quickly becoming disillusioned and deciding not to go back. For example, one young man managed to get a placement in a swimming pool where his role was to clean the floors and keep the place tidy, but in actual fact he spent most of the day in the pool swimming, and so that placement broke down quite quickly. And that wasn't only about his unrealistic expectations about what work involved, but it illustrated a lack of preparation by the support provider before allowing the young man to go out on placement. And that's one of the key issues. For example, the new Get Ready for Work training programme was introduced to provide greater flexibility for young people. But providers of that programme are already saying that there isn't enough flexibility there and they don't have enough time to work with young people to get them ready for the workplace before they have to send them out. So although that was introduced to provide greater flexibility, it can actually be very rigid in terms of the amount of time young people can remain on the programme. In some cases it can be as little as 6 months, and that for someone who is quite a distance from the labour market, it simply isn't enough time to prepare them for work. Other expectations, unrealistic expectations related to those of employers. We did some interviews, a small number of interviews with employers who had taken on people with learning disabilities, and there was a real lack of understanding about what the nature of learning disability was, particularly for young people with moderate learning disabilities, where the disability isn't always immediately apparent. Employers really had little idea of what they could expect young people to do. And so there's a real need for education for employers. There's a lot of stigma around in that some employers simply aren't willing to try taking on a young person with a learning disability. And other employers who do take on people really have no idea of what to expect and what their capabilities might be. Another barrier then related to the role of parents. And in this situation, what the findings of the research were, that parents were unintentionally holding young people back by being overprotective. They were stopping young people from taking opportunities that were available to them out of concern that they wouldn't be capable of carrying out the job. There was also an associated fear with parents about allowing young people to come off the benefits that they were on to go into employment. And that's the next barrier that's on the list there. Lots has been written about the benefit trap and why that might hinder young people from taking employment, but the type of work young people are doing tends to be poorly paid, and it's very unstable. Young people were finding it really difficult to sustain employment, so by asking people to come off of a benefit to go into employment is asking them to take a huge risk, particularly if that placement is, and in the case of the young people here, was more than likely to break down, and it's notoriously difficult to then get back onto the benefits that you were on before. So there's a huge risk involved there in asking young people to come off benefits. And the final barrier was the mismatch between young people and their needs and the services that were currently available. It's the same thing that's been happening in a range of areas and for a number of years, and that we expect young people to fit in with the services available, and we don't yet have flexible enough services that can just be tailored to meet the needs of individual young people. It was possible then to identify three models of transition which the young people who took part in the research fitted into. And the important thing about that was that those people in each of those different models have had very different experiences, and each of those models require quite different policy and service responses. So I'll just run through each of the models and quickly give you the key features of each of those models. And this emerged from the research itself. So the first model was the logical model. I didn't manage to come up with very imaginative names for these models, and if anyone has any better suggestions, that would be good. The first model was the logical transition, which was basically a very linear transition, whereby young people would be likely to move from school onto further education and then possibly into paid employment. Not many people in the research fitted into this category. There were two or three, but the majority of people actually fitted into the chaotic transition. So this first logical model of transition was seen as a success story, if you like, and there's a number of reasons why young people might have fitted into that category. They were much more likely to be focused and to have a real idea about what they wanted to do when they left school. And they were also more likely to be realistic in terms of the expectations they had. They were also, crucially here, they were also likely to come from supportive families with a real strong work ethic who encouraged them. And they might have got ideas in terms of career development from what members of their family were doing. When they moved into the workplace or the training programme, they were lucky enough to have supportive employers or colleagues, which enabled the placement to be sustained. So this logical transition, there's clear progress being made. It might be slow, but it's definite progress. The next one is by far the most common transition, and that's the chaotic transition. This is a non-linear transition, and young people tend to move in cycles. So they've probably left school and moved on to further education. But from there, they're likely to have moved on to another further education course, and so this cycle continues. Or they'll move on to a training programme, leave that programme, possibly get employment. That placement will fall through, so they'll go back onto another programme, another training programme, find more employment, and so the cycle continues. Young people in this category do make progress in terms of soft targets, so their confidence has increased and they've been gaining important work experience and new skills along the way. But the key characteristic of this group of young people is their inability to sustain a placement for any length of time. So the likely reasons for this are the mismatch between the skills that the young people have and the jobs that they're securing. There's a lack of understanding, as I've already said, by employers about the nature of learning disability. And the crucial thing here is the lack of support available for young people on a long-term basis. What happens is the minute that the support is withdrawn, young people's placements collapse. And so the crucial thing for this group of young people is the need for ongoing support on a long-term basis. But the financial implications of that are considerable, and who should be responsible for providing that support on a long-term basis? So the final group then are the disengaged group. And this group of young people have the most difficulties, both for themselves, but it's also difficult for professionals to deal with this group of young people. Young people start off in a similar position to those in the chaotic transition, but their placements are likely to have been more difficult or unsuccessful, and they might have had some really quite negative or traumatic experiences which have really knocked their self-confidence. So any progress that they have made in terms of these soft targets that the Scottish Executive talk about is eroded, and they lose the confidence and the skills that they've built up. And the key change occurs when these young people no longer aspire to work. One of the significant things was that despite the barriers, the majority of young people who took part in the research continued to aspire to find paid employment. But for those in the disengaged transition, they no longer aspire to work, and what they do is disengage from services completely. So the reasons for that then is that there might be a lack of appropriate services available. Young people might see services as not being relevant to them, and after a period of being passed from service to service, young people become disenchanted and just don't want to know anymore. And then the dilemma occurs about what to do with young people when they reach that position. And there's lots of issues around choice there too. So, as I said, each of those models of transition require different policy responses and different service provision. So what currently exists then? What were the young people currently experiencing? The service provision that young people were experiencing was patchy, and it varied by locality. So, for example, supported employment was readily available in some areas but not in others. The patchiness and the wide array of different services led to confusion over what the role of different services were, and it wasn't even clear whether they always met the needs of young people. So, for example, young people weren't sure whether to approach Careers Scotland for guidance or whether they should be going to Job Centre Plus. It wasn't clear what the different function of those two organisations were. And there are a range of training providers offering very similar programmes for young people too. So there's confusion over who should take responsibility for the provision of ongoing support. And this is the key This was the key message that came out of the research, was that young people, in order to make the transition from school to further education, training or employment, young people need ongoing support, and it really wasn't clear who should actually be providing that support on a long-term basis. The majority of programmes that were available for young people were time limited and lasted for a specific period of time, and it's not clear who will take responsibility when the service provision ends. So in addition to the confusion that exists about who should take responsibility, there's been some trends which have had an impact on the services that young people have had and experienced. The first thing Lara touched upon earlier was the change in classification from special educational needs to additional support needs. We now have a much broader grouping of young people who are looking for and seeking support, and young people with learning disabilities no longer appear to be a top priority. For example, the introduction of key workers, which was seen as a very positive move, this was one group of staff who were available to provide support on a long-term basis, but only two of the young people of the 20 actually qualified to have a BT key worker. It appeared that having a learning disability on its own wasn't enough to qualify to have a key worker. You had to have additional support needs over and above that. So, for example, you might have had to recently have left care or have issues around alcohol or substance misuse in order to qualify to have a BT key worker. In addition to that, the movement towards mainstream service provision for all young people meant that young people were increasingly having to access the support they needed through mainstream provision. So Job Centre Plus, for example, has moved away from having specialist disability advisors to mainstream advisors for people with additional support needs. In addition to that, the reconfiguration of traditional day services has meant that there is a real emphasis not only on mainstream service provision, but also on finding employment. And so in Glasgow, for example, we have the Equal Access to Employment strategy, which suggests that everyone in the city should have the same opportunity to hold down meaningful and paid employment. And so what we're seeing is a movement away from traditional services towards more community-based services and an increasing focus on employment as the route to social inclusion. All of this, then, it seems to have raised more questions than it answered. And we can argue that young people with moderate learning disabilities today in Scotland have greater opportunities than they have had in previous years. There are more choices and opportunities available than there ever have been. And there are many, many advantages to further education, training and employment for young people. Young people value these opportunities, and they have been able to develop new skills and increased confidence and participate to a much greater extent in mainstream society. But young people with learning disabilities are still much more likely than young people in the general population to be part of this neat group. That is the group who aren't in further education, training or employment. So although young people have increasingly similar opportunities to young people in the general population, it seems that they are still being disadvantaged as a result of the learning disability. In addition, it's really important to remember that the young people who took part in this research project occupied a borderline position, and that they had a moderate learning disability and were able to make the transition between mainstream and specialist services. The picture for young people with more severe or profound disabilities would be very, very different. So are young people with learning disabilities enjoying greater social inclusion than previously? Well, it would seem that they are in some respects, but there are still these difficulties in sustaining placements, and the type of placements which young people are likely to attain tend to be low paid and in unstable environments. The situation has greatly improved, but young people continue to experience segregation and social isolation, even in mainstream settings. And it became clear throughout the process of the research that employment was regarded as a panacea by all those involved, by young people, by their families, by service providers and by policymakers. And it was argued that supported employment is the best vehicle to achieve this. But if we actually look at the facts, there's very, very little research evidence that shows that supported employment is successful in maintaining young people in employment on a long-term basis. We don't yet have the research evidence to back that up. And focusing on improving young people's skills and employability might be setting them up to fail. I think what we have to ask is if employment is to be successful, we need much more flexible and ongoing support. And we need to really think about, is an intervention worthwhile if all we're doing is putting people in a situation where they continue to be marginalised financially and socially? So should we focus more on supporting people to make choices and support them to act on these choices? And if employment isn't a realistic option for all young people with learning disabilities, what other valued options are there? And unfortunately, it does leave more questions than it answers, but perhaps that's something we can discuss. Thanks very much.